Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kelleton. We have a really extraordinary couple hours for you today. Second hour, Professor Ron Rischlak will be here with us to talk about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. You might remember Professor Rischlak from his really astounding, impressive book, Hitler, the War, and the Pope, when everyone a few years ago, about a decade ago, was piling on and attacking Pope Pius XII as Hitler's Pope and whatnot. He wrote that extraordinary book, Hitler, the War, and the Pope, to defend Pope Pius XII. And it's really, I think, thought of now as the definitive book defending Pope Pius XII. This hour, we have a pro-life open forum, 888-318-7884, the number 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question or a comment or would like to engage in a bit of debate and argument, all of those things are welcome, having to do with the pro-life issue, the pro-life cause. I'm sure there are questions and concerns people have about Charlie Gard and those types of things. But pro-life, when we say pro-life, we mean human life begins at conception and ends at natural death. And anything having to do with the time between those times, I suppose you could say fertilization as well. I'm remembering now that our favorite scientist, Stacey Trasankos, says, well, the scientific word is fertilization, and it is a complex process, but there's no mystery. That's when life begins. And so from then until the natural death of a person, that there is a dignity to that life that precludes things like, for example, experimenting on embryonic human lives or using embryonic human lives to, enhance the lives of the person who may benefit from those, or there, and all the way till the end of life, where we would say, well, taking a life intentionally, any innocent life intentionally through euthanasia or assisted suicide, and those things are not acceptable. Because we value life in all of its stages. Sometimes the complaint is made, well, you value life when it's under attack like that, but you don't value life, for example, when it's the life of the poor or helping. And I think that sometimes that's a bit of a red herring, but we're happy to discuss it with you. 888-318-7884 is the number. Dr. George Delgado is our guest this hour. Dr. Delgado is the medical director of the Culture of Life Family – of Culture of Life Family Healthcare. And he's board certified in family medicine, in hospice and palliative care medicine. He also completed the certification program in healthcare ethics offered by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And I am told that are we awaiting Dr. Delgado, or do we have Dr. Delgado? We have Dr. Delgado. Thanks for being with us.
I'm here.
I'm so glad. I wasn't sure looking at Nick if he had you there. You are, well, how should I say this, popular or unpopular? Because I saw an article in you about you in a national magazine this week, Weekly Standard. I assume you saw the article.
I did not see that one, but there was also an article in Sunday's New York Times magazine.
It seems that a lot of people are upset at you.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people are happy. A lot of people are upset.
Yeah, exactly. But why?
Depending on their perspective.
But you seem to have added a new tool to a woman's choice that she can make. And it seems like the people who are pro-choice advocates are the most upset with you about this new choice you have given women.
That's right. And that really begs the question, if they really are pro-choice, why don't they want to give a woman a second chance at choice? And that's a woman, of course, who's taken mifepristone, the abortion pill, and changes her mind and wants to try to stop the medical abortion process. So we give them that opportunity through abortion pill reversal. And these women are very, very grateful, very happy. They express their gratitude to us all the time. And yet these people who call themselves pro-choice are quite unhappy and quite disconcerted.
Well, let me ask you this. Are there children today on this earth because their whose mothers took the first part of the abortion pill kind of process, and then were treated with your method that you developed of I think it's a high dose of progesterone. Is that correct that you treat?
That's correct.
And are there children alive on this earth today because of that process?
There certainly are. There are hundreds of them alive because of that process, and we're very, very happy about that. And those are the reasons why we keep doing it, for them and also for their mothers, because their mothers, like I said, are very grateful, and they are our biggest supporters.
Well, the piece in the Weekly Standard just listed news outlet after news outlet that had attacked you about this, like Marie Claire magazine, for example, attacking this as fake science or something like that. And yet we have seen the results of the work. The way that I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this, but a woman who wants to go through this process of chemical abortion takes two pills, one to make the lining of her uterus unwelcoming to the child and the other to expel the child. And between the taking of the two pills, there has to be a period of time. And the woman may regret it after taking the first one and say, no, I don't want to do that. And so you develop this process whereby she could get this dose of progesterone and may very well save the life of the child. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And the first medication, what it does, it causes separation of the placenta, or what's called a trophoblast at that stage of development, from the wall of the uterus. So it cuts off the nutrients, the oxygen to the unborn baby, and that then leads to the death of the embryo or fetus. And the second medication is given because anywhere from 20 to 40% of the time, the uterus does not completely empty itself of the remains of the preborn baby. And so that second medication is to ensure that there are sufficient uterine contractions to empty out the uterus.
888-318-7884, our number. And so when you see these attacks, the attacks on you, attacks on your practice as a doctor, but you've taught this to many other doctors. And then they are using it. And as you said, hundreds of children are alive because of this process. Why the in your view, is it what is the I don't know if that it's obvious. Why would people be so opposed to this process?
Well, I think they are opposed because perhaps that the whole idea that someone would want to reverse a medical abortion then calls into question the great value and benefit of abortion itself. Because for these proponents of abortion, I think they feel that abortion is such a great thing for women that they have to defend it and support it at all costs. So that anything that would question that mindset, that would question whether if all women really think that abortion is such a great thing, then calls into the question, why should everybody support abortion? So they see that as undermining their support. And really the whole philosophical underpinning of the abortion mentality. And so because of that, they will defend it to the end.
And now, just to be clear, before we have to go to a break, a woman who may take the first pill in the process of this chemical abortion, how long does she have in which this treatment might be successful?
We have studied it out 72 hours after taking the first medication, the mifepristone.
Okay. So if she were to go home in that evening, for example, and say, I what have I done? I don't want to do this. She could come to you or find another doctor who's trained in this and receive this dose and very likely save the life of the child.
Right, exactly.
Well, as I suppose I was teasing you a little bit about how unpopular you are, but I must say there's many, many people who are very, very happy that this treatment is available, not least of which those children who have had the opportunity at life. Again, 888-318-7884, our number, 888 318-7884. It's a pro-life open forum. Any questions you have about life, about medical questions having to do with the maintenance of life, or when is it time to accept that death is imminent? All of these questions are welcome. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Bishop James Wall from the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This spectacular online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, track, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my book on Mary, Behold Your Mother. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to shop at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 13, Jesus spoke of a sower who sowed some seed that fell on the path. The birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground with little soil. It sprang up quickly, but was scorched by the sun. Thorns choked some as it grew. But some fell on rich soil and produced fruit of 100 or 60 or 30-fold. Whoever has ears, he said, ought to hear. In other words, whoever has the rich soil of an open mind and heart ought to understand what he was saying. Undoubtedly, there were some there whose attitudes were choked by the thorns of self-interest, or whose superficial interest was shallow of the soil of sincerity. Most of us lack the adequate requirements for His love to flourish in us at one time or another, but He doesn't give up on us. Good Friday shows us how much He wants us to hear Him. Whoever has ears ought to hear. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Full hour of pro-life open forum this hour with Dr. George Delgado. 888-318-7884. Any question you have having to do with medical ethics or life issues, we're happy to take that this hour. Let me just remind you that we're giving listeners a chance to download a free copy of an MP3 from Trent Horn and Patrick Madrid when you sign up for the Catholic Answers Live newsletter. All you do is text the word Madrid, M-A-D-R-I-D, to the number 44222 on your cell phone. You follow the directions and you get a free copy of the MP3, The Communion of Saints and Purgatory by Trent Horn and Patrick Madrid. That's Madrid to the number 44222. We'd love to send it to you. And that is all that it takes. Again, I want to remind you, next hour we have an extraordinary author on with us. We will be discussing the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and focusing particularly on the legal side of those things. This hour, a full hour of pro-life open forum with Dr. George Delgado. Dr. Delgado, there are quite a few calls. Are you ready to just dig right into them?
Let's go for it.
Allison in Mount Vernon, New York, listening on EWTN. You are on with Dr. George Delgado. What's your question? Hi, Allison. It sounds like Allison is very pro-life. She's got a bunch of kids there in the background that she's got to deal with. So we'll go to Bridget. We'll come back to Allison. Don't worry. We're not going to abandon her. Bridget in Bakersfield, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Your question for Dr. George Delgado.
I've heard about the medicine that you provide, and I think it's really, really great. The one question I had is, if a woman has taken the first abortion pill and changes her mind and gets access to this medication, is there a chance that the baby could be born with birth defects because it's already lost oxygen?
Yeah, that's a great question, Allison. And it turns out we really need to look at both medications to see about birth defects. First, the mifepristone, which is the birth control pill itself. And it turns out that there is no increased risk of birth defects in humans who are exposed to mifepristone. So it looks like it either kills the preborn baby or it does not. And that's been shown by small research studies done in the past. And also our experience now with hundreds of patients has shown that we have not experienced an increased risk of birth defects. In addition to that, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is the big professional society that most OBGYNs belong, and they have actually, believe it or not, been against the abortion pill reversal process. But in a practice bulletin in March of 2014, they put out a statement saying that mifepristone is not associated with birth defects. So we have a lot of confidence that the abortion pill itself is not associated with birth defects. And that takes us to the second, which is the progesterone, which is the reversal agent, which is what we give the women to reverse the effects of the mifepristone. And progesterone itself has a very long track history of use in pregnancy, over 50 years. And the FDA has stated that it's not associated with birth defects. A very closely related compound called 17-hydroxyprogesterone caprate is approved to be taken through most of pregnancy to prevent preterm births. So we're very confident that women who undergo the reversal process are not subjecting themselves to increased risks of birth defects.
Okay, so I guess the reason I thought of it is because you said that the first pill cuts off oxygen to the fetus and starts to detach it from the uterus. So I thought if that was to happen and then that was to be reversed, then if the baby had been cut off from oxygen. But it sounds like once it's cut off, it's too late. So
exactly.
It would have to be before then. Okay.
Thank you very much, Karina, for that call. Let's see if we can get Allison back on the line again. Allison, you are on with Dr. George Delgado. What's your question? Hi, Allison. Allison, we'll be right back, Allison. Just stay right there. We're going to come back to you. We'll go while you're sleeping. We're going to head over to Karina in Canada, listening on EWTN. Karina, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to know, why are Catholics not allowed to do in vitro fertilization? And that's something, that's a question I always have a hard time answering.
Sure. And I think, if you don't mind, I would rephrase your question, and that would be, why shouldn't Catholics undergo IVF, or why shouldn't anyone undergo IVF, would be the better question, because there's no law that says Catholics can't have IVF. But there is a natural moral law that says we should not use IVF. And let me explain why. So first of all, for those of you who don't know, IVF stands for in vitro fertilization. And that's where a sperm sample is obtained from the father, potential father, usually through the unethical means of masturbation. And then eggs are surgically harvested from the potential mother, and the egg and the sperm then are mixed in a test tube or in a glass dish. That's why it's called in vitro. In vitro means in glass in Latin. The sperm and the egg unite, and probably several sperm and eggs unite, and you have the creation of zygotes, which then quickly become embryos. So you have a collection of embryos, which are the offspring of the mother and the father. And then those, one or more of those, are taken and implanted back into the mother who's been hormonally prepared so that the uterus would be accepting of these. And then if one or more of those embryos sticks, then the woman has an ongoing pregnancy and hopefully will deliver a baby. So what's wrong with all that? Well, there are several things, and you have to go back then to the whole, what we call theology of the body, using the terms of Saint Pope John Paul II, and that is that our bodies are created in such a way that they reflect God, and that reflection of God has a very profound meaning. It's such a profound meaning that what we call the marital embrace, when husband and wife come together, that has a very deep emotional, spiritual, and physical meaning. And that whenever you try to sort of unpack that and separate the various aspects of that, for example, with contraception, you try to have unity, the couple coming together, without procreation, that you literally destroy the supernatural meaning of that act. Well, the same goes when you try to take procreation out of the marital embrace and do it in a test tube. You're totally violating the meaning of the marriage and how the marriage should be a reflection of God. You're violating it on several ways. First of all, you're violating the relationship of the husband and wife, where that intimacy, where the egg and the sperm unite, should take place within their bodies, within a sexual act, number one. Number two, you're actually violating the dignity of the newly created person, because every human person has a right to be created within a loving, natural embrace of a marital union, not in a test tube so that the new person is treated as a commodity. And really, if you think about it, they are, because, as I inferred earlier, oftentimes several embryos are created. And several embryos are created for multiple reasons. One is so that the technician can then look at the embryos under a microscope and can pick out the ones that look the fittest. So if you think about it, this is eugenics at its most basic level. You pick the embryo that looks the best, it looks like it'll survive, and implant that one. So you pick siblings over other siblings. Other times they implant more than one embryo, knowing that the odds of one making it to delivery, full pregnancy, will be enhanced if there are other embryos implanted alongside with them, and knowing that one or more may not survive and may miscarry. So there it's you're sort of sacrificing siblings for the survival of another sibling. And lastly, there often are spare embryos. And what do they do with the spare embryos? They usually do one of three things. Number one, they just dispose of them. They throw them out. That's killing people, although microscopic people. Number two, they freeze them. Think about the violation of a person's dignity to be fast frozen in your development without your consent for no really beneficial reason for you. You're fast frozen in your development. And thirdly, some of them may be taken for medical research and they're destroyed in the process. So because of these and other things, in vitro fertilization should not be done by Catholics or by other people who want to follow the natural law, want to follow the design that God has given us for the dignity of all human persons. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So would we also be considered like a part of abortion, right?
Yes, actually, because when those, quote, spare embryos are thrown away, they are being aborted. They're being killed, and that's what abortion is killing pre-born people.
So if Catholics, in this case, if they do it, would that be considered a sin?
Well, again, when you talk about sin, you have to talk of what's objectively wrong. So objectively speaking, this is what we would consider a grave moral evil, or what often is called a mortal sin. But of course, any particular person, you can't say that that person has committed a mortal sin, because you don't know the amount of awareness that person had, motives and other coercion and other things. So that really, whether or not it's a mortal sin for any particular person, is between that person and God. But I would say that anybody who has gone through IVF, no matter how much they really knew what they were doing or didn't, and knew the implications and knew about the natural moral law, probably they should go to confession and make themselves right with God. But we cannot be the judges of how culpable or how much blame that they really have to shoulder. But I think it's a safe advice to say it would be great for them to go to confession and to learn about what they did was not the right thing in keeping with God's plan.
Okay, thank you so much, because there's no excuse and why people should do this, like you said, knowing that they're aware of what it is, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you're becoming more informed. You can tell these people why.
Karina, thank you so much for that call. It is a pro-life open forum this hour with our guest, Dr. George Delgado, 888-318-7884. The number, 888-318-7884. 888-346-7884. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Be a part of Mother Angelica's mission. EWTN Radio is seeking a dynamic producer to join our growing radio team. The EWTN Radio producer is responsible for managing all aspects of live and recorded programs, develops program ideas consistent with EWTN's mission, and collaborates with the leading voices in Catholic radio. For all the details about this exciting opportunity, click on employment at EWTN.com.
This is Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about a new resource so good it deserves a place in the library of every Catholic who is serious about his or her faith. Did you ever read something in the Bible that made you just scratch your head? Have you ever been challenged to defend a seemingly scandalous verse of Scripture? You're not alone. The Bible contains more than a few hard sayings, apparent contradictions, myth-like events and figures, and passages that seem to be embarrassingly out of step with modern culture or science. How can you, as a Catholic, reconcile such things with your own faith and with what the Church teaches about the inspiration and inerrancy of sacred Scripture? Don't worry. As my good friend and brother in the faith, Trent Horn, explains in his new book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties, God's revelation in the Bible is not something Catholics need to be ashamed of. In Hard Sayings, the first book of its kind, Trent examines dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture and offers clear, reasonable, and Catholic explanations to unlock their true meaning. He also provides basic principles for reading and interpreting Scripture that the wisdom of the Church has developed over the centuries. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Back, Pro-Life Open Forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being with us. We do appreciate it. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Dr. George Delgado, the Medical Director of Culture of Life Family Healthcare, is our guest this hour. And if you've got questions having to do with life, with medical ethics, we're happy to take them. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We have callers waiting, and I do want to get to them, Dr. Delgado, but there's a question that I have that I want to slip in here, and that is, when we look at the Charlie Gard case, there's all this about this one did this and this one did that, and all, but I wonder if we could just get to a basic question to ask you as both a person well-trained in medical ethics and as a doctor. What should have happened in the Charlie Gard case? How could it have been handled in a way that would have been better than what's happened?
Well, just a quick background for those who haven't heard about Charlie Gard. He's a baby in Great Britain who was born with a mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome that causes or has caused progressive muscle weakness and brain damage. The mitochondria are the power plants of all the cells in our body, so they're extremely important. And in the last 10 years, there's been a breakthrough in discovering all sorts of defects in mitochondria that are explaining a lot of diseases that people had that we couldn't understand before. And it turned out that he was born looking normal, but as time went on, his tissues essentially were depleted because of lack of energy, and then he started having breakdown. And he got to the point where he was looking like he was near death, and he had to be on life support on a ventilator. Well, Charlie's parents wanted to do whatever they could to try to treat him, improve his quality of life, and prolong his life, which is what most parents would want to do. But unfortunately, the hospital, Great Osmond Street Hospital in Great Britain, refused to allow them to pursue other care. They decided that when they were done treating him, they should be done, and they wanted to disconnect him and let him die. Well, then, of course, they appealed to courts in Britain and even to the court of the European Union. They all denied them the rights of parents to seek treatment for their children, for their own children. And this is despite the fact that they were able to raise money to go to the United States to get some experimental treatments. They still said, no, we will not let you go. So what I think should have happened is that the heavy-handed authorities in Britain and in the European Union should have said, let's allow parents to make the best decisions for their children as long as they have the means and the ways to do that. Of course, if they were in a healthcare system where there are limited resources, then of course you could say that limited resources, we just can't afford to do that treatment, and that would be acceptable. But instead, the family was able to get the funds to apply for the experimental treatment. They should have been allowed to do that. It shouldn't have been heavy-handed. And I'm a firm believer that, and I think good ethics would support me, that parents are the ones who make the best decisions for their children, and they should be allowed to give their children treatment that has some possibility of helping them. So I think that was the real problem, is that they were heavy-handed. Autonomy is such a big thing in medical ethics these days, but ironically, the surrogate autonomy that parents have over children was violated in this case. The autonomy was assumed by the hospital and by the governmental authorities, and that should not have happened.
And and that just seems so clear that the authorities, all the way up the line, all the way up to the European Court of Human Rights, had no inclination to credit the family as a unit and credit the parents as the proper caretakers for the child. But on the other hand, I wonder, do you ever see cases where you really need to convince someone it's time to let go? Like that if you continue with and I'm not saying that this is the case with Charlie Gard's family, but that sometimes we maybe have the attitude that I'm not a good parent if I don't just keep doing everything, when at some points there may be, you may be ethically crossing a line by overdoing it, by maybe making a child's passing or another person's passing torturous.
You're absolutely right. There always is a fine line to walk where you want to make sure that any treatment you're offering has some reasonable chance of success, and you want the burdens of that treatment to be minimized. And when you get to the point where the burdens far outweigh the benefits, then that's when really you've reached the point of futility, where there's really no hope at all with any current treatment. And that's where they are right now, and that's why the parents have finally decided, yes, we're going to stop fighting this, and they are going to go ahead and withdraw the aggressive treatment, because they're seeing that there really is no hope for improvement, and now they're just prolonging suffering, prolonging the dying process. And so there, it's fine. The parents are in agreement with that. But even in this case, one more point, something that hopefully would not happen in this country, that the parents want to take the child home to die at home. And my last reading of the reports is that the hospital is refusing that. And good hospice and palliative care bends over backwards to allow people to do things like die at home and to take people home on ventilators. And there a way to have, you know, you have portable ventilators, take the child home on a ventilator and then disconnect the ventilator there at home and allow the natural dying process to occur there. So that was another bone I have to pick with how this was handled.
Really? I mean, I don't want to accuse anything of it, but this seems almost vindictive. I mean, the parents have accepted the child is dying. This hospital has accepted the child is dying. They want the child to die at home. That doesn't seem to be a hard one.
That's right. No, it doesn't.
I'm going to move on from my frustration. We have John in Howland, Minnesota, listening on 90.3 FM. John, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. So I just had a question about the overall ethics of abortion. What are the do's and don'ts when approaching an abortion in real life? Do you have any time where you say, hey, you know, this is a situation where abortion is the right choice, or is there really any time that it's all right?
Yeah, that's a great question, because sometimes we do encounter areas that seem rather gray and sometimes fuzzy. But I think it's always good to go back to foundational principles first and get those straight in your mind, and then you look at the particular case. Because otherwise, if you look at the case first, let's say look at a case with a mother who has pulmonary hypertension, bad lung disease, where if she gets pregnant, she's going to get very sick and might die. And then you look at it first from that point. You say, oh, my goodness, we can't do anything to let her die. So whatever it takes to save her life, even if it's abortion, is justifiable. But that is when you get into what's called utilitarian ethics. And that's a bad rabbit hole to go down. And that's unfortunately where ethics in Western civilization are going right now. But instead, if we go to the foundational principles and we ask ourselves, okay, what is abortion? And we have to define our terms, of course. But generally, when people say abortion, they mean what ethicists would refer to as direct abortion. And a direct abortion means that it's an act where the intention and the direct act are to end the life of a preborn baby. Okay, so that's pretty much what we mean by abortion, what most people mean. So we'll just to clear that up. So therefore, abortion or direct abortion is the ending of an innocent life. And we ask ourselves then, is it ever justifiable to kill an innocent person directly? Is that as the primary intention? And the answer to that, of course, is no. It's never justifiable. That is what we call an intrinsic evil. Just like I could never be justified in killing you if you were not doing anything to threaten my life. That would be unethical. It would be immoral. So abortion is what we call an intrinsic evil. It's never something that we can justify. So we start from that, and then we move from there. So let's say we have that woman who has the severe lung disease and is pregnant, and it's going to get very sick and may die. Well, what we can do is aggressively treat her illness, even if we knew that that treatment would have two effects. And here I'm, of course, referring to the principle of double effect, where let's say you gave her a very strong medicine that would make her lungs and heart better, but at the same time could potentially injure her preborn baby or even kill her preborn baby. That would be acceptable because the intention would not be to kill the preborn baby, although it might be foreseen. But that's not your intention, and you have that second good effect of the action, which is to treat the mother. We also see this all the time with a much more common situation called a tubal pregnancy, where the baby implants in the tube, and we know that we're justified in treating that tube by cutting the tube out, which we know saves the mother's life, but at the same time will end the preborn baby's life because we're cutting off all nutrition to it. And so that is kind of sums up how we would look at abortion and how we can sometimes justify what can be termed an indirect abortion technically, but we don't use the abortion word in that sense, like with the tubal pregnancy. Does that make sense?
It's supposedly like 16 years old.
We missed the beginning of the question. Could you repeat it?
Oh, yes, I could. Sorry. I think you got cut off. That was a very good analysis. I guess one thing that I hear from one of my friends is, say you have a 16-year-old who gets pregnant and she is just not able to take care of the child financially at that point, and a possible emergence of a child from her would potentially just create poverty for both her and the child. Would you say that an abortion being used would actually save someone financially speaking, even though it's at the cost of someone's life? Or is it better off to have a child under those harsh financial circumstances, even though they can't predict that their lives will eventually get better from that?
Right. So that's a good scenario to ponder. And I would just say that, first of all, the value of that preborn baby's life is much greater than any potential risk for poverty for that baby. And life itself has inestimable value, and the contribution that a preborn baby would give to society is something that you cannot predict, number one. And number two, going back to the fact that we should never kill an innocent person, we should not kill that innocent preborn baby just because of the financial situation of the mother and her family. Just like we should not go to let's say, a very poor country, or even into a very poor area in our country, let's say into an inner city where there's a lot of poverty, no one would ever say you should go there. And if you find a single mother with a one-month-old baby, that we should take that baby and kill it because that baby is a financial drag on the mother. No one would ever support that. So why would we support killing a similar human being who's just several months younger and just happens to be in the uterus instead of outside of the uterus? So that's how I would answer that, is that killing a person is never an answer to poverty. The person already exists. It's just a matter of that person transitioning from an in utero existence to an extra utero existence outside of the uterus. And killing that baby is not an answer. Now, what might be the answer, and probably part of the answer, would be giving that mother all the support she needs, giving her financial support, giving her emotional support, and maybe raising the question, maybe that 16-year-old is not equipped to raise a child right now, and perhaps adoption would be a great option for her so that she can make sure that baby's in a loving home, and she could then get on with her life and hopefully from then on lead a chaste life and get an education and then find someone to marry and do things in the right order.
John?
Okay. Oh. Are you still there?
We are. I think you got a lot to ponder there, John. It sounded like you already started pondering it.
And, I do.
We got to head to a break, John. So I have to say thank you for that call. 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll be right back. Happy to take your calls on this pro-life open forum today with Dr. George Delgado. Be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Time is running out to help Catholic Answers' annual summer campaign. It's a crucial time because we need to offset the drop in donations that occurs every summer. We're making progress toward our goal, but we still need you to help. Souls are on the line, and your help lets us reach millions of people every year. Catholic Answers publishes books, booklets, CDs, and digital content, bringing you the best in Catholic apologetics and evangelization. Our flagship publication, Catholic Answers Magazine, is the leading journal of Catholic apologetics. Catholic Answers speakers reach tens of thousands of people every year. Every single month, more than 1 million people visit Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com. We also encourage people across the country and around the world through online social media, including Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other online platforms. We maintain a staff of full-time apologists to answer questions by phone and email from people who need personalized help. Catholic Answers Live features prominent leaders in the church and answers listeners' questions on every aspect of church life. It's available to you by radio, online, and now it's seen on EWTN television. If you care about your Catholic faith and want to see it grow, please help Catholic Answers continue this vital work. To hear how you can help Catholic Answers, visit Catholic.com and click the 2017 Summer Campaign banner. That's the 2017 Summer Campaign banner at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, track, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my new book, Why We're Catholic. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com. and take advantage of our very special prices. These materials will build up your faith because they're from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Dr. George Delgado, our guest. You should look in Weekly Standard or in New York Magazine this week to see articles about Dr. George Delgado. I can't say that they said there is flattering, because he does live on the cutting edge of the struggle for a culture of life and light. 888-318-7884, our number, open forum, a pro-life open forum. This hour we go now to Claire in Walnut Creek, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Claire, your question for Dr. Delgado.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. When I stand outside of Planned Parenthood is I'm under the impression that the girls who go in for the first pill that they take for the RU486, they actually stay inside for quite a while. And I was wondering the reason for that. And then I'd also like to know when they take the second pill, which I understand they take at home, what are the possible complications that could happen for these girls when they're alone at home?
Yes, so the first pill, the mifepristone, they're required by the protocol that the FDA approved that it be taken under direct observation. And that is to make sure that the person they've examined or at least screened is actually the one who takes it, that they don't take that pill and go give it to somebody else, because it definitely would have a street value if they could do that. So that's the main reason why. It also is a byproduct of the early studies where when the women took the medication, they were observed for several hours. And so it's also an outgrowth from that. Now, the second set of pills, because it's actually a set of pills called misoprostol or Cytotec, that's the one that causes the uterine contractures, it's taken 24 to 72 hours later. So in order for the clinics not to cut costs, but really under the guise of convenience, the women take it at home so that they expel the remains of the preborn baby at home, and really the clinic doesn't have to deal with that. But again, this is under the guise and auspices of having the abortion experience in the privacy of one's own home. So you can ask, well, what about side effects and complications? And I think those are good questions, because they really are out on their own. They don't have a follow-up appointment after that. And how are these women going to know if they're bleeding too much, if not enough has come out, or even if they've developed an infection? So these are really some of the risks that they encounter with taking the second one at home and not having any real medical supervision for it.
Does that help you, Claire?
Yes, it does. Yes. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
And
you're welcome.
Claire, I assume you're outside of those Planned Parenthood clinics because you're saying the rosary or something along those lines?
That's exactly right. Yeah, right. Pro-life, yeah.
Well, God bless you, and thank you for that work that you do. We go now to Anne in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, Dr. Delgado. My husband and I are struggling with infertility, and we're wondering what good moral Catholic options are for male infertility. There's a lot of stuff out there for female, but we're having trouble finding anything for male infertility.
Yes, well, the male infertility has been studied less than female infertility, so there are fewer treatments, but there are some available. Assuming your husband has not had a vasectomy and does not have any kind of a structural problem or things are not connected the way they should be, there is hope as long as there is some sperm present. So there are some men who make absolutely no sperm, what we call azoospermia, and for them there really is no real hope for treatment, and they really should go straight to adoption. But if it's a man who's had a vasectomy, there's the potential for vasovasotomy, which is vasectomy reversal. That can be very successful, especially done under expert hands. If the man has a low sperm count, then we can give a medication called clomiphene that can help boost the numbers. If a man has poor morphology has to do with the shape of the sperm. And really, if you think about sperm cells being like swimmers, because they are swimmers, if you look at the typical swimmer in the Olympics, usually it's going to be their tall people, let's say they're men because we're talking about sperm, tall guys with long arms and a classic V shape where their shoulders are very wide, waists are tapered. And you can look at a guy and you look at Michael Phelps and you can say, boy, he looks like a great swimmer, and indeed he is. Whereas if you have a short, pudgy guy, short arms and maybe a protruding abdomen, you can look at that guy and say, hey, he's probably not such a good swimmer. And usually you'll be right. Same thing with sperm. You can look at them under the microscope, and by their morphology, how they look, you can predict which ones are good or not. And so men who have sperm with good morphology, they tend to be more fertile. And then, of course, it's the swimming itself. So not only do you look at the swimmers, but in the Olympics, they do trials. They'll swim against each other, and whoever wins the race, he's the best swimmer, and he has proven himself. Well, same thing, you can look at the sperm under the microscope, and you can see how well they swim, how many of them are moving around. Not only that, but you can also look at the how many swim forward, because you don't want a sperm doing the backstroke going away from the egg. You want them doing freestyle going towards the egg, because that's the goal. And so whenever there's poor morphology or poor swimming, we also have certain supplements and minerals that can be given to help with that. And we often use a proprietary brand called Prox Seed that you can buy online. And there are other brands, too, that can help with that. The other things that a man could do is to avoid overheating the scrotum, because the reason anatomically why the scrotum hangs down from the body is because sperm do better at slightly lower temperature than body temperature. So men who have fertility issues, we want them to wear boxer shorts so that the scrotum can hang low. We don't want them to be sitting in hot tubs or saunas where things can get overheated. And we want them to be careful if they do a lot of bicycle riding, because they can compress the scrotum and the testes there. So those are some of the things that are ethically very appropriate and acceptable to all religious and philosophical groups that can be done for men who have infertility. And there are a few other things. There are some medications that we want to avoid. For example, the blood pressure medicine called diltiazem is actually pretty toxic to sperm. We want them to avoid that, as well as a few other medications. So if the man is on any medications, he should have a very good close examination of those medications by a good medical professional to make sure that none of them could be harming fertility. We want to make sure the man's getting enough sleep at night, plenty of exercise, and eating good wholesome foods, drinking lots of fluids, and probably avoiding foods that could be contaminated with female hormones, because we know that birth control pills or flushed down toilets, that excess hormones are probably peed out by the women, and that these are into the environment and they're causing a lot of problems. We know that there have been fish discovered in the Hudson River that have ambiguous genitalia, probably because of all the female hormones that are in the environment. So avoiding those as best possible would also be a good idea.
Does that help you, Ann?
It does. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Short arms and pudgy, you're not a good swimmer. Is that it? That actually explains a lot about
me. That's the take-home point of the day.
Yeah, well, that for me personally, that helps to explain a great deal. We go now to Aaron in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Aaron, we only have a short time. Real quick, your question for Dr. Delgado.
Hi. I saw in the news that there was research where they developed like an artificial womb and started growing sheep or something like that. And my question is, it seems like it'd be problematic if they started using that to grow humans on purpose. But is there a scenario where, like, if a woman not on purpose delivered a baby prematurely, where that would be acceptable from the Catholic point of view?
That's a great question. I think in that scenario, it would be acceptable because it would be the equivalent of a incubator that you have used in hospitals now, where there was sort of by nature or by accident, there was a premature delivery and that baby needed to be sustained. What would be problematic would be starting the pregnancy or the gestation from the get-go in an artificial womb. I think that probably would violate ethical boundaries because the preborn baby has a right to be gestated, to develop inside his biological mother's womb.
And that's where we have to leave it, Aaron, because we are at the end of our hour. Dr. George Delgado, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Next hour, very serious topic. Excellent guest to tackle that serious topic with us. We'll be talking about the persecution and genocide of Christians in the Middle East. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.